Accession number 30274, Reel 3.
Mr. Wainwright, we Reel 5. What did you think of the Cromwell compared with the Sherman tank?
Oh, the Cromwell was very good. Had a Rolls-Royce engine. The tracks were very good. They were an improvement on anything we'd had before. Because, as you can understand, with a weight of over 30 tons sitting on the tracks, and the tracks taking all the traction and having to be the means of steering, there was a great strain on tracks. And if your tracks behaved very, very well, that was a great plus, and the Cromwell's tracks certainly did. And they were quite fast. You could go up to 40 miles an hour, and they were good over awkward country, like the Sherman, like the Cromwell very well.
Was that a three-man tank as well?
What?
Was that a three-man tank?
No, five. A driver who slides in under the sloping front. He has two sticks, not a steering wheel, one stick for right track, one stick for left track. A clutch accelerator. If I remember rightly, there were eight gears, but that varied with different tanks. And whether I'm right in saying it was Cromwell or not, I don't know. But a lot of gears, and had to be managed in the old crash style. And next to him also slipped in under the front on his right-hand side, a second driver. He had a machine gun. Then the turret. The turret could be rotated completely, and in the turret were three men. The breech of the gun, the breech was a very large amount of metal, and there had to be just sufficient space for a long shell, a 75, to be picked up, put into the breech, and when it had been fired, for the shell case to come back. So a lot of the turret was not available to human beings. The gunner sat on the left on a seat, and he had foot and hand controls, and he was responsible for the actual sighting, finally. But the tank commander, who was behind him and able to be up either partly out of the turret or looking through a periscope, he was the one who had to judge the range and give instructions to the gunner. And then the radio operator was the loader for the big gun, and the gunner had control not only of the big gun but of a machine gun as well. The radio operator had two sets. One was for the troop, and the other was for the squadron and regiment. So altogether, there are no words which would tell anybody what it was like living in those very restricted conditions. And of the physical stress that was put upon you with the tank movement joggled about all the time, wearing old-fashioned heavy Bakelite earphones for speaking to your crew and for the outside world as well, and the noise of the engine, and when you're actually fighting, the noise of the guns. I finished up by being put out of tanks because I could no longer hear the messages properly. And that was one of the big things. But living with a tank, like living in any other frontline conditions, is indescribable. Nobody can appreciate it until they've done it. Anyway, where did we get to?
You landed at Aramont D-Day
plus one. Aramont, D-Day plus one. Yes, and then I spoke about the cows in line. Well, watching what went on the D-Day landing is something which people can appreciate to some extent from the amount of films that have been shown. But that leaves out all the personal elements of strain and stress and anxiety and excitement. So we fought here and fought there, and eventually there was the breakout to the north, and we were at one point there leading and going through Caen. And on the other side of Caen, I had one of these experiences which has stuck in my mind, and that was ruins all round, and suddenly out of the ruins there emerged a young woman with a shawl, and in the shawl a baby, and she was absolutely on her own, standing there looking dazed. And I spoke to her and told her that she was all right, that we were British and she would be looked after. If she would walk that way, she would find Le Croix Rouge, the Red Cross. And that, to me, epitomized the sort of ruin on the one hand and personal distress on the other that was being caused all the time. Then we went on and we came to a small town, and we went to the northern rim of it, and we were told to wait there, and somebody else took over the advance, but we sort of just spread out to make a guard in case the Germans tried to come back. And the people eventually came out of the houses, and my tank was quite near the pavement, and the houses were next to the pavement, and they discovered I could talk French, and that helped quite a lot. And then one lady appeared and she said, would I go with her round the corner to her estaminet? And I said to my chaps, well, I'll go with her, but keep your eyes open in case there's anything funny going on. And we didn't have rifles, obviously, in tanks, but we had revolvers, which were in a holster on your right thigh. So with my hand on the revolver, I went round the corner with this lady, and here was a little cafe with the tables all set out, and said, yesterday the German officers were here, today it is you, come with me. And she opened the door at the back of the estaminet, and we went into another room, and there was a fireplace there with a high mantelshelf, and she reached up onto the mantelshelf and lifted down a tin, and she opened the tin and held it in front of me, and she said, this tea was given to me by the British soldiers before they went to Dunkirk, and we kept it because we always believed that the British would come back. And here we were, and she brewed the tea for us. I thought that was pretty good. And then later, and not very much later, I was back at the tank, and a tall man came, obviously a local Norman. If you've been there, you know the type I mean. Tall, very black haired, very dark eyes, heavy eyebrows, very florid cheeks, and in his case a big black moustache, wearing a beret and quite nicely clad. And he had discovered I could talk French, and we were talking, and he said that he was the proprietor of another estaminet up at the station, and he named the place, which wasn't very far away. And Embley is quite a prosperous sort of man. And after we talked a bit, he went away. And he came back and he was carrying a wicker basket, the sort you used to see on the front of boys' delivery bicycles here. And it was with compartments. And the compartments were standing bottles in. And there were five bottles. There were four bottles of wine, one for each of my crew, and a bottle of whiskey for me. So I thought this was very kind of him. I wondered just what lay behind it. And again he said, will you come with me to my house over there? So once again I said, well, I'll just keep an eye on this. And I went with him. And when we went into his house, there were two ladies. One, a very old lady, dressed all in black, sitting very upright on a straight wooden chair and wearing quite a big black hat. I don't know whether you know this style of the old mother, grandmother, who would be very prim and proper. And she looked at me and turned to this man and said, "Est-il anglais? Si, maman." And she leapt off the chair and put her arms around me and hugged me. Relieved, knowing that they were going to be safe again. And those two incidents stuck in my mind. So from there we went on, and it was fighting, staying. And then we got up to an area where things were quiet, in that we were having a rest, and it was there that I reported that I could not hear properly. So I went to the MO, and the MO checked. He said, well, you shouldn't be there at all, you know, you're a minus and not a plus. So I was at that point taken out of the 1st Royal Tank Regiment as such, and put with a group of people, wounded and whatnot, who were being sent back, as we understood it, to Bayeux, which was just near Aramarche, where we'd landed, all that way. And we set off in various ambulance trucks, and we got to Brussels. And at Brussels, we were stopped, and we were told that we were going back to England. So I thought, this is a great joke. What a rotten thing to try and pull our legs. However, it turned out that all the planes had been ordered to go back to England on this particular day, which was a Friday. And we were put onto a plane, we being a group of about five of us, by a chap who was quite obviously from Newcastle. I said to him, you're a Newcastle lad, I'm a Newcastle lad. He said, yes. So he got us on this plane, but it wasn't very long before we were taken off the plane and told that it was required for some generals who had to be conveyed. And we were taken back to the base from which we had come in a truck. And I saw this sergeant, and I said to him, I said, I wanted to see Newcastle just as much as he did, and the rotten beggars had thrown us off the plane, and here we were. What could he do about it? So he said, just wait there, and I'll see what I can do. And he got us another truck and took us to another plane, and he did it because we were in Newcastle. And that was the last plane that left Brussels Airport on that Friday. And it wasn't until the Sunday that we knew why all the planes had been called in. And Sunday was the day when they did the drop for the bridge. We saw the planes go, and learned afterwards that they were taking all the paratroopers. So that's how we got back, and I was in hospital in Derby. But while we were in France, there was one particular incident which really is worth talking about. And this was, we had got in our troop, number 4 troop, 1st Royal Tank Regiment, a new 2nd Lieutenant, Richard Lay. And he'd only been with us a day or two, and we were making an advance, and we were in very difficult country because the Normandy fields are quite small, and they have round them ridges on which trees grow and shrubs, and the cover is very difficult in that you don't know who is lurking, and your advances are very, very dangerous. Anyway, we got into some of these fields all right, and the first thing you have to do is get all your fuel and ammo dealt with before you do anything with human beings. And it was up to midnight before we had got this done, and there was not going to be any question of bedding down. We'll just be sitting in the tanks overnight. And Richard Lay came up to me and he said, "Sergeant, will you have a drink with me?" He said, "It's just on midnight and it's my 21st birthday." So we had the drink, and then next morning we set off. I was leading tank of the regiment, and we were the leading regiment in the area as far as tanks were concerned. And we went forward, and we came to a place where we were on a road, and there were fields to our right and a wood. And in the wood there was some German armament which was causing difficulty for the infantry, who were trying to advance across this field and capture the wood. And a voice came over the radio saying that the infantry seemed to be having some difficulty. Would one of your chaps be able to go and see if you can give them some help? So as I was leading tank, that was me, and I set off across the field. And after a bit, I said, "Well, it seems to be nothing much happening there. What's going on?" So I said, "Well, we have not located whatever it was that was causing trouble." So our lot then advanced, and that meant that Richard Lay's tank was in the lead instead of my tank. And they went forward and they were shot up. The tank was set on fire and all the crew were killed, including Richard Lay on his 21st birthday. And what had happened was that my tank going across this field had scared the German away from the position they were in, and they had gone and changed their position, and it meant that they spotted Richard Lay's tank. That was pretty hard luck on him, but it should have been me. But there were so many times when it could have been me and wasn't. Going back to Alamein, the tank on my left was being driven by Norman Winning, whom I knew very well. He was a Newcastle chap, and his tank was hit. It wasn't penetrated, but the explosion was such that the shock killed everybody, and that was only a couple of yards away from me. And the same, as I've just said, about the one in Italy. The one on my right was the one that was hit. And I had an incident when my own gunner nearly shot me with our own machine gun. And another thing that happened in France was that on this very fast advance, the regiments have got all split up, and the squadron have got split up. And it turned out that there were only two of our tanks, Sergeant Lincoln, who was a regular in the proper 1st Royal Tank Regiment, and me, and our major and his second in command. And there was a canal which we needed to cross, but all the bridges that had been investigated had been blown except one, and it was the one that was just in front of us. So the question was what to do about this. So Ginger Lincoln and I lined up on the road which led to this bridge, and we were a few hundred yards from it, but not very far. And it was dark, and suddenly one of my chaps said, "Sarge, there's somebody on the back of the tank." I thought, oh crikey, Germans with a hand grenade going to drop it down into the tank. However, I bobbed up with my revolver and twigged that it was a French voice. And I said, "Who are you?" He said, "We're the resistance." And they were able to tell us that the bridge had been prepared for being demolished, but it had not yet been blown, which of course we could see. But on the other side of it, there were two 88s. They were the Germans' very effective anti-aircraft guns, which were very good for piercing tanks. And there were two, one either side of the bridge. So I reported this and explained about the resistance being on the tank and giving us all this information, and saying that the resistance were there ready to help for anything that could be done. And there was a question of what we should do, and eventually it was decided that the only thing to do was try to rush the bridge and see if we could get over and see what happened. Well, that was pretty sweaty. So, all right, we just got ready to start, and the bridge was blown up, and that settled that. So we then moved to a line of houses which faced on the canal, and they were semi-detached houses, which meant that there were gardens between each pair. And we went into these gardens in the dark and faced out, hidden as far as we could be hidden, over the canal. And when dawn broke, we could see the Germans come out of their tents and come to the guns, and they never tumbled that we were there, so we were able to shoot them up. That was another of the outstanding incidents. As I say, there were just two tanks. The rest were somewhere, but they weren't with us. And the two command tanks, and Ginger Lincoln's and mine, moved across to a farm. And our infantry were already at the farm, which they had taken, and they were moving across from a belt of wood which went to the left from the farm, over fields to a belt of wood on the other side, which they wanted, as usual, to take control of. So Ginger Lincoln and I went into this strip of wood to the left of the farm so that we could fire across into the wood and assist the infantry, and this we did. And the infantry got to the wood, so we knew that was all right, and we started to back out. And as we backed out, Ginger Lincoln's tank was blown up on mine. The Germans had invented a mine which didn't go off with the first vehicle that went over it. it went off with the second vehicle that went over it. So he had gone over the mine to get into the wood, and coming out, his driver was killed, the tank went on fire, but they got out. And I saw this happen, so I thought, well, crikey, I've got to do something about this, we've got to get out. So I said to my driver, reverse very slowly. And he did reverse very slowly. And the mine did go off. But because we were so slow, it went off under the far end of the engine and not under the turret or under the driver. So Freddie Durrant, who was the second driver, he had the presence of mind to pull the CO2 bottles, which were fire extinguishers, and we were able, all of us, to get out of the tank, except when we got out, Golly, the driver was still in. And we found that what had happened was that Edgar Williams hadn't traversed the turret so that it was dead straight, and the corner of the turret was sufficient to have trapped the flap of the driver's compartment, and he couldn't get out. So Freddie Durrant and I climbed onto the front of the tank and wrapped something rather around our arms, because the gun was red hot, you see, and we were fortunately able to push the gun and therefore the turret round and clear the lid for Golly to get out. So we were all right. We lost the tank, but we were all right. And we went into the orchard behind the farm. And as I say, the infantry had already cleared the farm, but there were some German prisoners in the orchard. And there was one of the tracked vehicles that the infantry used, and it so happened that I went and stood at the front of the track, and Freddie Durrant stood at the back of the track, and Frank Osterfield, who was our radio operator, was between us halfway up the track. And to our right were German prisoners. And I saw the shell come and drop next to Frank Osterfield and explode. And it didn't kill him outright, but he died. Yet not a shred touched Freddie Durrant, and not a shred touched me, but shrapnel hit the German prisoners. So Freddie Durrant and I, well, fortunately the infantry, some of them, saw this happen, and they came over, and they were going to call up their ambulance people to look after Frank Osterfield, who, as I say, died. And Fred Durrant and I went out of the orchard, and by that time some of our support trucks had come up, and one was a sergeant in charge of the workshop tank. And he had been able to get another couple of tanks running, and they had brought them up near this farm. And I thought to myself once again, well, I'll be spare crew for a bit, thank goodness. But it wasn't so, because Sergeant Stacy came across. He said, Eric, I've just had a message. You're to get another crew of anybody you can and take over one of these two tanks that I've just brought up. So I got a crew together and off we went again. No rest for the weekend.